The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated June 15th, 2012. Thanks for joining me today. We'll begin with the main story section. Our first article is entitled, Walker's Decisive Victory in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker easily survived a rare recall election this past week in a victory that deals a major blow to the labor union movement and may have implications for President Obama's reelection hopes in November. Walker's victory brought to an end 17 months of acrimonious debate in Wisconsin, sparked by the governor's decision to curtail collective bargaining rights for public sector unions and force government workers to contribute part of their salaries to their pensions and health care benefits. Outraged protesters occupied the Wisconsin Capitol in February of 2011 and went on to collect nearly 1 million signatures to trigger this week's recall election, which pitted Walker against Democratic challenger Mayor Tom Barrett of Milwaukee. But Walker's campaign spent $45.6 million on the contest, almost two-thirds of which came from out-of-state donors, while Barrett spent only $17.9 million. In the end, Walker won by a healthy 53-46 margin, making him the first governor in U.S. history to survive a recall election. The decisive nature of Walker's victory led to speculation that it might shake up the presidential race. President Obama won Wisconsin by a 14-point margin in 2008, but even some Democrats conceded that after the recall battle, the state was likely to be in play in November. "We're going to remain a very competitive state heading into the fall," said Mike Tate, chairman of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, who nonetheless predicted a victory for Obama. Now here's what the editorial said. "Let this be a lesson to big labor," said the Wall Street Journal. "Your monopoly claim on taxpayer wallets is at an end. Voters have overwhelmingly endorsed Walker's attempt to rein in the public union's ability to extort unaffordable salaries and benefits from the state. Perhaps that's because they can see it's worked. The state has already saved over $1 billion by renegotiating labor and health care contracts, and property taxes have fallen. Other political leaders should take note. An aroused electorate can defeat a furious and well-fed special interest." Wisconsin's public sector arguably needed reforming, said USA Today, but Walker did not help himself by doing it in a way that wasn't even-handed. He cut Democratic programs such as Medicaid and education while sparing Republican priorities. So while teachers saw their collective bargaining rights eliminated, for example, police officers did not. The result? A costly, wasteful election that did nothing but stoke bitterness and more partisanship. Walker needs to learn that polarizing the electorate is no way to govern. Now here's what the columnist said. "This wasn't Walker's victory," said Joan Walsh in Salon.com, "but a victory for the GOP's plutocrat donor base, which flooded the governor's campaign with more than enough cash to drive the final nail in labor's coffin. This brutal display of post-Citizens United politics should be a wake-up call for Democrats," said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. "The GOP showed it can levy its huge financial advantage to weaken the opposition in a structural way, burying the left's grassroots operation beneath an avalanche of negative advertising. Obama should be worried." I don't think so, said Alec MacGillis in the NewRepublic.com. Walker's victory is more likely to do with voters' desire to stick with the guy in charge than with ideology or the presidential campaign. In fact, when viewed as evidence of grudging pro-incumbent sentiment, Walker's victory might even bode well for Obama. Are you kidding? Said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. This was a clear ideological battle in which conservatism prevailed. Anyone who thinks Walker's win doesn't portend more Democratic defeats in November just isn't paying attention. The recall vote may not prove to be a bellwether for the general election, said Ross Dutat in NYTimes.com, but it's not anything like good news for liberalism. Just as Obama used his mandate to push through health care reform, so Walker used his mandate to enact public sector reforms. Where one spawned the Tea Party, the other gave birth to a recall election. But while the Tea Party helped punish Democrats at the polls in 2010, labor unions and liberal activists failed to punish Walker's union busting. The message to lawmakers, it's safer to take on left-wing interest groups than conservative ones, and safer to cut government than to increase revenue. In the battle for the future direction of our country, conservatism just took the lead. Our next item in the Week magazine for this week, Obama faces another dismal jobs report. Here's what happened. New figures showed the U.S. jobs market sputtering badly in May, damaging President Obama's reelection prospects and stoking fears of a global slowdown. The Labor Department reported last week that payrolls for the month climbed by just 69,000 jobs, half the gain economists had predicted, and the lowest uptick in a year. New jobs in healthcare, transportation, and manufacturing were more than offset by losses in the leisure and hospitality sector and in construction, which lost 28,000 positions, the industry's worst month in 2 years. The already shabby jobs tallies for March and April were also revised downward, reducing average monthly job gains over the past 3 months to 96,000 versus 252,000 from December through February. And for the first time since last June, the unemployment rate ticked up from 8.1 to 8.2%. The report was an ominous development for Obama, who is locked in a dead heat with his Republican rival Mitt Romney. The president's reelection campaign slogan may be forward, said Romney, but it seems like we've been moving backward. Obama admitted that the economy was not creating jobs as fast as he would want, but vowed that it would improve. We will come back stronger, he said. Now here's what the editorial said about this issue. The Republicans own this slowdown, said the New York Times. Last fall, President Obama pushed Congress to approve a new $450 billion stimulus package. That plan would have created up to 1.9 million jobs by increasing state funding for teachers, cops, and firefighters, and providing much-needed investment in infrastructure. But GOP lawmakers blocked the proposal, calling instead for more cuts in federal spending to reduce the deficit. In the meantime, millions of Americans need jobs. Here's more proof that we can't spend our way out of this mess, said the Wall Street Journal. Despite Obama's $800 billion stimulus and some $2.5 trillion of pump priming by the Federal Reserve, the weakest economic recovery since World War II has become weaker still. The lesson of the Obama years is that stimulus money can provide only temporary relief from otherwise rotten policies. To get business hiring again, we need lower taxes, less red tape, and most importantly, a new president who understands how the economy works. Now, here's what the columnist said. Let's not panic, said Paul Davidson in USA Today. Although it might not feel like for millions of Americans who are unemployed or whose wages are barely rising, the economy is actually measurably better than it was 3 years ago. Manufacturing is stronger, vehicle sales are higher, and a nearly moribund housing market is showing a stronger pulse. Growth is far too meager, but at least we're not sliding back into another recession. That's cold comfort for the president, said Paul West in the Los Angeles Times. Three incumbents have lost re-election bids since World War II, Presidents Ford, Carter, and Bush Sr. And even they didn't have to cope with a jobless rate as high as Obama almost certainly will in November. It no longer matters that Obama's policies help prevent a Great Depression, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com, or that some 4 million jobs have been created since 2010. The key to his fate is the trend. Earlier this year, Obama could argue that the economy was turning around and that he deserved another term. But with these miserable numbers on the table, let's be honest, Mitt Romney now has a good chance of being the next president. Maybe so, said Eduardo Porter in the New York Times, but what we should all be worrying about is just how little sway either Obama or Romney has over the forces most perilous to the U.S. economy. If debt-ridden Greece pulls out of the euro and the single currency collapses, global financial markets will plummet, wiping out the savings of many ordinary Americans. Our exports would also slow as Europe's economies contracted, depriving the United States of one of its few engines of growth. The fate of our economy is as likely to be sealed by Berlin and Athens as it is by the presidential vote in November. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the Week magazine. This one is entitled, Romney, Can a Businessman Fix the Economy? Mitt Romney is running for president on the strength of his business background, said Jim Zaroli in NPR.org. But does America really need a CEO in chief? That question will loom large in the presidential campaign, especially now that the latest jobs report indicates that the nation's economic recovery is slowing down. Keenly aware of its vulnerability on the economy, the Obama campaign is targeting a new line of attacks on Romney's business background. One new ad repeats the now familiar charge that Bain Capital, Romney's private equity firm, made rich investors richer by buying struggling companies, laying off workers, and driving the companies into the ground. Another ad puts a harsh spotlight on Romney's job creation record as the governor of Massachusetts. Under the headline, Romney Economics, it didn't work in Massachusetts and it won't work now, the ad notes that under the former CEO, Massachusetts ranked 47th out of 50 states in job creation. Little wonder Romney hates to talk about his time as governor, said Margaret Carlson in Bloomberg.com. As the ultimate job interview gets underway, his 4 years in Massachusetts are a gaping hole in Romney's resume. Obama's attack on Romney's governorship is slanted and misleading, said Josh Hicks in WashingtonPost.com. It's true that Massachusetts lost manufacturing jobs under Romney from 2003 to 2007, but the state's employment figures had been in free fall for 2 years before he became governor, and the average annual rate of loss slowed every year during his tenure, falling from 7% when he started to 1.8% when he left. Romney's record at Bain Capital is also nothing to be ashamed of, said Investors Business Daily in an editorial, especially compared with Obama's failed job creation strategies. As CEO of Bain, Romney created more jobs and economic growth than any number of failed stimulus packages and green energy boondoggles. If Obama insists on making economic acumen an issue in this campaign, he's going to lose, and the American people are going to win. Based on U.S. history, said Timothy Egan in NYTimes.com, a business background is more often than not a prelude to a disastrous presidency. Our economy has boomed under presidents with no corporate experience at all, including Franklin Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. Businessmen Herbert Hoover and George W. Bush, meanwhile, gave us the two worst financial crises in history. When surveying a candidate's resume, the general rule seems to be that the less experience in business, the better the president. Besides, Romney has already revealed what he'd do to revive the economy if elected, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. He has made a commitment to cut taxes for the rich by 20% and to deeply cut domestic spending for the needy under Representative Paul Ryan's Radical Path to Prosperity proposal. If you believe in trickle-down economics, Romney is your man. Romney's plan and record may not matter in this election, said Steve Carnacki in Salon.com. If the economic recovery continues to sputter, all Romney has to do is present himself as a generic, suitably qualified alternative to Obama. Swing voters may ignore the fine points of the debate over Romney's Bain years and the red flags the Obama campaign is raising about Massachusetts, and focus on the fact that Romney has clearly been successful. Given the grouchy mood of the nation, millions of struggling American voters may decide to take a chance, hit the reset button, and put someone new in the White House. Now from the Week magazine, we'll move to the popular feature entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for extreme measures after a British man changed his name to Tim Price to deter telemarketers. When these salesmen see my name on their list of names to call, they'll think, blow that. I can't even pronounce his name. Price explained, and that is spelled with one P and probably a half a dozen at least other P's before Price is added to it. It was a good week for being prepared after a nuclear missile silo turned condominium complex in Kansas sold out of its $2 million apocalypse proof condos. The underground condos have off-grid electricity, epoxy-hardened walls, a pool, a fitness room, and a movie theater. It was a good week for Snigdha Nandapati, a 14-year-old from San Diego, after she won the U.S. National Spelling Bee by successfully spelling Getapens. And I'm going to spell that for you because I'm not real sure that I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's Getapens, and it means an ambush. This is a miracle, she said. It was a bad week for the continuing cost of obesity after an Austrian crematorium burst into flames while burning the corpse of a 440-pound woman. The unusual mass of body fat caused the oven to get too hot, burning down the building. It was a bad week for evidence after a new Gallup poll found that 46% of Americans believe in creationism, that God created humans in their present form within the last 10,000 years. And it was a bad week for Letitia Vester of Florida, who was arrested after allegedly phoning a bomb threat to her employer, Metra Electronics, so she could get a day off from work. She's definitely getting the break she wanted, said the local police chief at the Volusia County Branch Jail. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the People's section. And our first article here is entitled Levine's Feminine Appeal. Adam Levine is an unabashed womanizer, said Craig Marks in Details. Over the past decade, the Maroon 5 singer has been linked to a bevy of beauties, including Kirsten Dunst, Maria Sharapova, Natalie Portman, and Cameron Diaz. Levine credits his extended family for his success with the opposite sex. One of my theories on why I'm so capable of understanding women is that after my parents split, my mom moved in with her brother's ex-wife, my aunt, who was also newly single, he explained. So I was living in a house with two jilted women plus my cousin, who's more like my sister, and my brother Michael, who we eventually find out is gay. Just the estrogen alone. You know when you're 14 and terrified to talk to a girl? I didn't suffer much from that. It seemed very natural to me to talk to girls. The 33-year-old pop rocker thinks that promiscuous men typically fall into one of two categories. There are men who are misogynist pigs, and then there are men who just really love women, who think they're the most amazing people in the world, he says, and that's me. Maybe the reason I was promiscuous and wanted to sleep with a lot of them is that I love them so much. The next article from the People section is Amis's Aging Battle. Old age has crept up on Martin Amis, said Mick Brown in the Daily Telegraph in the UK. The novelist, famed for his competitive spirit, used to relish putting visitors through their paces on the tennis court. But at age 62, he doesn't play anymore. It just got so tragic, he sighs. My game was built on mobility. I didn't have any big shots. It's more to do with reflexes. The ball's out of reach, and it fills you with self-disgust. Nowadays, he can't even watch soccer on TV, as he can't operate the latest high-tech remote control. Pathetic. The technology has moved beyond my competence, he says. He recently lost his closest friend of 40 years, the journalist Christopher Hitchens, the only friend, he says, with whom he could be emotionally naked. In one respect, Hitchens' death left him better off. It's a shameful secret that the death of a friend increases your love of life. You treasure the moments on their behalf. Even so, he reckons he will never come to terms with it. Christopher grappled with the Nietzsche line, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." Amis gives a bleak smile. "I always thought that was all balls, but what doesn't kill you makes you weaker and kills you later on." And the next article here is the Saudi woman who dared to drive. Manal al-Sharif was arrested last year while driving around her home city, said Guy Adams in The Independent in the UK. She hadn't broken the speed limit or run a red light. Sharif was guilty of being a woman who dared to drive, a crime in Saudi Arabia. After 9 days in jail, she emerged to a worldwide fame. A film of her protest cruise, shot by a friend, went viral after being uploaded to YouTube. That video and Sharif's subsequent campaign for women's rights led to a barrage of death threats. "The harsher the attacks," she says, "the better I am doing." Sharif, who is 33, is an unlikely reformer. She grew up in a conservative family and remembers burning her brother's pop cassettes after mullahs told her that music came from Satan's flute. But Sharif's life changed in 2009 when she moved to Boston for work. "For the first time, I could live a normal life. I could look at apartments and sign a contract without a man's approval. Most importantly, she could drive a car. I thought, this is how life should be." Soon after returning home, Sharif challenged the authorities with her now famous journey. "You know what," she says, "they messed with the wrong woman." Now we'll turn to our reading of the briefing for this week. This particular week's edition is entitled, "The Drone Over Your Backyard." U.S. skies are being opened to police and private drones. Will it be the end of privacy? Drones are coming to the U.S.? Well, they're already here, and the drone era is just beginning. Predator drones, the same remote-control, camera-equipped aircraft used to hunt terrorists in Afghanistan and Pakistan, have been patrolling U.S. borders since 2005. Emergency responders have used smaller drones to search for missing persons and track forest fires, and police departments in Florida, Maryland, Texas, and Colorado are testing drones for surveillance and search and rescue missions. Last month, the Federal Aviation Administration, acting at the behest of Congress, relaxed the rules for deploying unmanned aerial vehicles. Police departments across the country can now fly drones weighing up to 25 pounds as long as the aircraft stay within sight of the operator and fly no higher than 400 feet so as to not get in the way of commercial aircraft. More rules easing restrictions on commercial drones are expected by 2015. By the end of the decade, the FAA expects 30,000 unmanned aerial vehicles, some as small as birds, to be peering down on American soil. Why are they allowing more drones? Law enforcement officials love them. They believe the mobile eye-in-the-sky technology will improve public safety at a low cost. With high-resolution cameras, drones can help police patrol large areas, spot runaway criminals, and track drug shipments. And since a small police drone with a camera can be purchased for around $50,000, with some basic models costing as little as $300, they're far cheaper than standard helicopters, which can cost $1 million or more. Our neighborhoods deserve safer streets, and these systems can help provide that, says Representative Buck McKeon, a Republican from California. Defense companies have also lobbied hard to bring the technology stateside, with the market expected to double to $12 billion by 2020. Police agencies shopping for drones that fit the new FAA regulations can already choose from 146 models manufactured by 69 different companies in North America. We see a huge potential market, says Ben Gilo of the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, an industry trade group. Are domestic drones different? They're not armed with missiles, but otherwise the technology is similar, with domestic drones ranging in size from a small airplane to a hummingbird. The Predator drone used on the border has a 66-foot wingspan and needs a runway to take off. Most other drones are made to be easier to use. They might be launched by hand, like the military's Raven, or fit in the trunk of a car, like the Cube police drone. Many are controlled remotely from the ground via a laptop or even an iPad, while others can fly autonomously on a programmed flight path. AeroVironment, a leading supplier of military drones, has developed a palm-size hummingbird drone that carries a video camera and weighs less than a AA battery. It's capable of flying 11 miles per hour and landing on a window ledge where it can record sound and video. Well, what can these drones do? Mainly, they can snoop on people without their realizing it. Drones can read license plates, spot body heat at night, or identify faces. In 2009, police in Austin launched a bird-sized drone called the Wasp over a drug suspect's house before sending in a SWAT team. Last year, a North Dakota sheriff called in a Predator drone from the Canadian border to locate a rancher and two sons suspected of cattle theft and to make sure the trio, all members of an anti-government group, were unarmed. And if drone lobbyists get their way, police won't be the only ones with the technology. Real estate brokers have already used drones to photograph for sale properties, and in the future, the devices could be used to monitor oil pipelines, dust crops, or snap paparazzi photos of celebrities. What about privacy? The American Civil Liberties Union warns that drones may profoundly change the character of public life, ushering in an era in which Americans could be monitored every time they step outside. Important roads and public spaces might be constantly patrolled by hovering drones. Fences and property lines may no longer serve as barriers to police surveillance or peeping toms. You want to sunbathe in the nude on your own property, says Jay Stanley of the ACLU. Now you can't be sure nobody is watching you. That prospect alarms many people. A recent Rasmussen poll found that more than 50% of Americans oppose drones' use in domestic skies. Still, in separate cases in 1986 and 1989, the Supreme Court ruled that police don't need a warrant to observe a private property from public airspace. And some argue that in this era of private data mining, government scrutiny of emails and phone calls, and ubiquitous security cameras in public places, privacy is already moot. What remains to be seen is how the public reacts as drones regularly start showing up overhead. The technology is here, says Peter Singer, a robotics expert at the Brookings Institution, and it isn't going away. And the footnote to this briefing section article, a drone of one's own. Drone manufacturers and law enforcement aren't the only ones eager to see unmanned vehicles hit the skies. There's a growing and enthusiastic subculture of do-it-yourself drone makers across the United States who spend weekends tinkering on homemade drones. Chris Anderson, the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, is perhaps their biggest evangelist. Several years ago, he brought home a toy robotics kit and a remote-controlled airplane, and he combined the two so that the plane could fly on autopilot. His kids went back to their video games, but Anderson was hooked. He created DIYDrones.com, a site for amateur drone enthusiasts that now has more than 25,000 members. They say the proliferation of cheap sensors, chips, and cameras make it easier than ever to assemble your own flying robot. If you have an iPhone or an Android, you basically have an autopilot in your pocket, says Anderson, who compares DIY drone makers to early personal computer hobbyists. Right now, drones are scary, Anderson says. I'd like to make them unscary. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm glad you're here. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S., according to the Week magazine. The first one is entitled, Why Obama Leaks Like a Sieve. Peter Brooks in the New York Post is the author. The president of the U.S. isn't supposed to brag about secret intelligence operations, said Peter Brooks. Someone ought to tell Team Obama the latest deliberate White House leak came last week with a detailed New York Times report that confirmed that the U.S. and Israel were behind the Stuxnet computer virus that attacked Iran's uranium enrichment program. The story revealed that Stuxnet was part of a large cyber war program codenamed Olympic Games, which continues to this day. Thanks to the leak, the mullahs know for sure who was behind the operation and may seek revenge with a cyber attack on the U.S. In the past 2 years, this White House also leaked a trove of operational details of how it found and killed Osama bin Laden, leading to Pakistan's jailing of a doctor who provided helpful information. More recently, it blabbed about how a double agent helped stop another underwear bomber plot by Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Why all the leaking? In an election year, these classified operations make the insecure president look tough. But compromising national security for purely political reasons is shameful. The next column is entitled The Rules for U.S. Military Intervention by Michael Kensley in Bloomberg.com. When it comes to the question of using military force abroad, Americans are divided in strange ways, said Michael Kensley. The old hawk-dove division has splintered, and now there are liberal hawks and conservative doves doves, as well as conservative hawks and liberal doves. In this complex taxonomy, liberal doves, who see all foreign interventions through the prism of the Vietnam War, oppose almost any use of U.S. power. Bleeding hawks, however, think the world's lone superpower cannot stand idly by while dictators like Bashar al-Assad massacre civilians. Conservative doves, who trace their roots back to pre-World War II isolationists, see no point in going to war to save foreigners. Conservative hawks, including the neocons who championed the war in Iraq, reflexively favor the use of American military might. They see peril to the U.S. everywhere and want to stamp it out. So what's the right way to decide whether to intervene abroad? Why Libya and not Syria? Iraq but not Iran? Unfortunately, it all depends on who's president, how recently we've intervened elsewhere, and whether it's an election year. And the next column is entitled, John Edwards Guilty Only of Creepiness. And it's written by Emily Bazelon in Slate.com. Loathsome, but not a criminal. That will be John Edwards' political epitaph now that his trial for violating campaign finance law has sputtered to an end, said Emily Bazelon. The former vice presidential candidate was acquitted on one count of campaign finance fraud last week with a mistrial on five other counts. Legally, that's about right. Edwards is a world-class creep for cheating on his cancer-ridden wife, but federal prosecutors never should have brought criminal charges against him. The prosecution claimed that Edwards failed to report $900,000 that two rich friends spent to hide his pregnant mistress in 2007, while Edwards continued to run for president. But campaign finance law is very fuzzy, and jurors said they were torn, ultimately deciding there wasn't enough evidence to send Edwards to jail. Indeed, the charges against Edwards seem quaint, given the hundreds of millions of dollars tycoons and super PACs are spending to influence the 2012 election. Perhaps our country can now forget about Edwards, who is broken and irrelevant, and focus on the mockery that is campaign finance law. And now we will flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week to the section entitled The Last Word. And this particular article this week is entitled Lost in the Great Alone. Bloodied, terrified, and exhausted, I was 2 days into an 1,100-mile hike, says Cheryl Strayed, and ready to quit. I am technically 15 days older than the Pacific Crest Trail, which runs from Mexico to Canada along the crest of nine mountain ranges. I was born in 1968 on September 17th, and the trail was designated by an act of Congress on October 2nd of that same year. Though it wasn't officially dedicated until 1993, almost 2 years before I woke that first morning among the Joshua trees in the Mojave Desert. The trail didn't feel 2 years old to me. It didn't even feel like it was about my age. It felt ancient, knowing, utterly and profoundly indifferent to me. I woke at dawn but couldn't bring myself to so much as sit up for an hour, lingering instead in my sleeping bag. The wind had awakened me repeatedly throughout the night, smacking against my tent in great bursts, sometimes hard enough so the walls whipped up against my head. It died down a few hours before dawn, but then it was something else that woke me, the silence, the irrefutable proof that I was out here in the great alone. My plan was to hike the PCT from the Mojave Desert to Washington State. Later on, I told someone I met on the trail the reasons why. I was 26 and recently divorced, 4 years before my mother had died suddenly of cancer at age 45, and in my grief, I'd gotten off track. I thought spending 3 solid months alone in the woods carrying a pack so heavy that I could barely lift it would help me find my center. I crawled out of my tent and stood slowly, my muscles stiff from yesterday's hike, my bare feet tender on the rocky dirt. I still wasn't hungry, but I forced myself to eat breakfast. I drank the last of the water in my bottles and awkwardly refilled them from my dromedary bag, which flopped heavily in my hands. According to my Bible, the Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, I was 13 miles away from my first water source, Golden Oak Springs, which in spite of yesterday's poor showing, I expected to reach by day's end. I loaded my pack the way I had the day before in the motel, cramming and wedging things in until nothing more would fit, then attaching the rest by bungee cords to the outside. It took me an hour to break camp and set off. Almost immediately, I stepped over a small pile of scat on the trail, a few feet from where I'd been sleeping. It was black as tar. A coyote, I hoped. Or was it a mountain lion? I searched the dirt for tracks, but saw none. I scanned the landscape, ready to see a large feline face among the sagebrush and rocks. I began to walk, feeling experienced in a way I hadn't the day before, less cautious with each step in spite of the scat, stronger beneath my pack. That strength crumbled within 15 minutes as I ascended and then ascended some more, pushing into the Rocky Mountains, walking switchback after switchback. My pack's frame creaked behind me with each step, straining from the weight. The muscles of my upper back and shoulders were bound in tense, hot knots. Every so often, I stopped and bent over to brace my hands against my knees and shift the pack's weight off my shoulders for a moment of relief before staggering on. By noon, I was up over 6,000 feet and the air had cooled, the sun suddenly disappearing behind clouds. Yesterday it had been hot in the desert, but now I shivered as I ate my lunch of a protein bar and dried apricots, my sweat-drenched T-shirt growing cold on my back. I dug the fleece jacket out of my clothing bag and put it on. Afterward, I lay down on my tarp to rest for a few minutes and, without meaning to, fell asleep. I woke to raindrops falling on my face and looked at my watch. I'd slept for nearly 2 hours. I hadn't dreamed of anything, hadn't had any awareness that I'd been sleeping at all, as if instead someone had come up behind me and knocked me unconscious with a rock. When I sat up, I saw that I was engulfed in a cloud, the mist so impenetrable I couldn't see beyond a few feet. I cinched on my pack and continued hiking through the light rain, though my whole body felt as if it were pushing through deep water with each step. I continued up into the late afternoon and evening, unable to see anything except what was immediately before me. I wasn't thinking of snakes, as I'd been the day before. I wasn't thinking, I'm hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail. I wasn't even thinking, what have I gotten myself into? I was thinking only of moving myself forward. My mind was a critical vase that contained only that one desire. My body was its opposite, a bag of broken glass. Every time I moved, it hurt. I counted my steps to take my mind off the pain, silently ticking the numbers off in my head to 100 before starting over again. The blocks of numbers made the walk slightly more bearable, as if I only had to go to the end of each one. As I ascended, I realized I didn't understand what a mountain was. I'd not grown up around the mountains. I'd walked on a few, but only on well-trod paths on day hikes. They'd seemed to be nothing more than really big hills. But they were not that. They were, I now realized, layered and complex, inexplicable and analogous to nothing. Each time I reached the place that I thought was the top of the mountain or the series of mountains glommed together, I was wrong. There was still more up to go, even if first there was a tiny slope that went tantalizingly down. So up I went until I reached what really was the top. I knew it was the top because there was snow, not on the ground, but falling from the sky in thin flakes that swirled in mad patterns, pushed by the wind. I hadn't expected it to rain in the desert, and I certainly hadn't expected it to snow. As with the mountains, there'd been no deserts where I grew up, and though I'd gone on day hikes in a couple of them, I didn't really understand what deserts were. I'd taken them to be dry, hot, and sandy places full of snakes, scorpions, and cactuses. They were that, and also a bunch of other things. They were layered and complex and inexplicable and analogous to nothing. My new insistence was beyond analogy. I realized on that second day on the trail. I was in entirely new terrain. I walked the rest of the afternoon with my eyes fixed on the trail immediately in front of me, afraid I'd lose my footing again and fall. It was then that I spotted what I'd searched for days before, mountain lion tracks. It had walked along the trail not long before me in the same direction as I was walking, its paw prints clearly legible in the dirt for a quarter mile. I stopped every few minutes to look around. The landscape was mostly a range of blondes and browns, the same colors as a mountain lion. I walked on, thinking about the newspaper article I'd recently come across about three women in California. Each one had been killed by a mountain lion on separate occasions over the past year, and about all those nature shows I'd watched as a kid in which the predators go after the one they judge to be the weakest in the pack. There was no question that was me, the one most likely to be ripped limb from limb. I sang aloud the little songs that came into my head, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, and Take Me Home, Country Roads, hoping that my terrified voice would scare the lion away, while at the same time fearing it would alert her to my presence, as if the blood crusted on my leg and the days-old stench of my body weren't enough to lure her. As I scrutinized the land, I realized that I'd come far enough by now that the terrain had begun to change. The landscape around me was still arid, dominated by the same chaparral and sagebrush as it had been all along. But now the Joshua trees that defined the Mojave Desert appeared only sporadically. More common were the juniper trees, pinyon pines, and scrub oaks. Occasionally I passed through shady meadows thick with grass. The grass and the reasonably large trees were a comfort to me. They suggested water and life. They intimated that I could do this. On the afternoon of the fifth day, as I made my way along a narrow and steep stretch of trail, I looked up to see an enormous brown-horned animal charging at me. "Moose!" I hollered, though I knew that it wasn't a moose. In the panic of the moment, my mind couldn't wrap around what I was seeing, and a moose was the closest thing to it. "Moose!" I hollered, more desperately as it neared. I scrambled into the manzanitas and scrub oaks that bordered the trail, pulling myself into their sharp branches as best I could, stymied by the weight of my pack. As I did this, the species of the beast came to me, and I understood that I was about to be mauled by a Texas longhorn bull. "Moose!" I shouted louder as I grabbed for the yellow cord tied to the frame of my pack that held the world's loudest whistle. I found it, brought it to my lips, closed my eyes, and blew with all my might until I had to stop to get a breath of air. When I opened my eyes, the bull was gone. So was all the skin on the top of my right index finger, scraped off by the manzanitas, jagged branches in my frenzy. The thing about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, the thing that was so profound to me that summer, and yet also, like most things, so very simple, was how few choices I had and how often I had to do the thing I least wanted to do. How there was no escape or denial, no numbing it down with a martini or covering it up with a roll in the hay. As I clung to the chaparral that day, attempting to patch up my bleeding finger, terrified by every sound that the bull was coming back, I considered my options. I could go back in the directions I had come from, or I could go forward in the direction I intended to go. The bull, I acknowledged grimly, could be in either direction, since I hadn't seen where he'd run once I closed my eyes. I could only choose between the bull that would take me back and the bull that would take me forward. And so I walked on. And that article was from the book Wild by Cheryl Strayed. It was copyrighted in 2012 and published by arrangement with Alfred A. Knopf, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Incorporated. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Talking Points section. Our first article this week is entitled, Soda, Will a Ban on Big Cups Reduce Obesity? New York City's nanny-in-chief is back, said Julie Gunlock in the New York Daily News. First, Mayor Michael Bloomberg banned the cigarettes from bars and restaurants in the Big Apple, and then he moved on to a prohibition on trans fats in restaurant food. Now Bloomberg has proposed banning the sale of supersized sodas and other sugary beverages from his city's restaurants, movie theaters, and stadiums, with a 16-ounce limit per cup. Too much soda is a leading cause of obesity, the mayor says, and it's time to attack the culprit. But most scientific research indicates that our obesity crisis stems mostly from overeating, and New Yorkers will be able to circumvent this silly soda ban by simply buying two 16-ounce sodas instead of one giant one. Why is Bloomberg pushing a prohibition that has so little chance of working, said Gregory Kane in WashingtonExaminer.com. It can only be because he feels like it and because he can. We don't usually endorse Bloomberg's trademark nannyism, said the New York Post in an editorial, but this is different. The mayor doesn't want to ban soda, but to encourage us to consume less of it. Studies have found that people eat and drink more if you put more in front of them. Reducing portion size in an effective way to get people to cut down on calories, and let's face it, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times, we're fat folks. Seriously, dangerously fat, and the pale-size, sugar-laden 32 to 48-ounce cups of soda now peddled in movie theaters and fast food chains aren't helping. Bloomberg is just trying to push back against the new normal and reset our distorted expectations. St. Bloomberg should spare us from his meddling, said Trevor Butterworth in the DailyBeast.com. The holier-than-thou mayor is enthralled to behaviorism, the condescending idea that changing our environment will force us to change our fallible free will. But singling out soda for causing obesity is absurdly arbitrary. If Bloomberg wants to save New Yorkers from their gluttony, why not insist on maximum calorie limits on everything else restaurants serve? By relentlessly acting like he knows better, Bloomberg has become the country's best argument for libertarianism. It is hard to think of a better way to turn soda into a symbol for intrusive, meddlesome government than to have a humorless billionaire poking his finger of disapproval into one's daily life. And the next article, College, When the Rich Get Scholarships. Should a multimillionaire's son get a free scholarship to a university that's slashing its budget and raising tuition? Asked Dennis Romero in LAWeekly.com. If that son plays football, well, guess so. The kid in question is Justin Combs, son of hip-hop impresario and clothing mogul Sean Diddy Combs, who recently won a $54,000 per year football scholarship to the University of California in Los Angeles. Most people think an 18-year-old whose dad is worth about $550 million and who gave him a $360,000 Maybach sports car for his 16th birthday shouldn't get a free ride to a school where student tuition and fees have nearly tripled in the last 10 years. Diddy should do the decent thing and give the money back, said Pat Morrison in the Los Angeles Times. Better still, he could cut a check to UCLA for a matching scholarship for some talented young scholar who couldn't otherwise afford to study there. Mini Diddy is hardly the first rich kid to win a scholarship, said Brian Kendall in BleacherReport.com. I don't recall anyone complaining when Archie Manning's boys Eli and Peyton won football scholarships at state universities, but their dad wasn't an African-American hip-hop mogul whose lifestyle might offend middle-class sensibilities. Could that be it? Instead of lambasting Justin, we should be lauding his achievements. Not only is the 5'9", 170-pound cornerback an outstanding football player, he also graduated from high school with an A-minus average. Three other colleges offered the kid a scholarship, said David Haglin in Slate.com. And UCLA may yet benefit from having Combs attend. His dad called a scholarship offer from UCLA, one of the proudest moments of my life. The proud papa might one day show his appreciation with a hefty endowment. And we have time for a couple of short articles here as we reach the end of our program. When the media covers women's issues, men do most of the talking. Among 35 national newspapers and magazines, men had 81% of the quotes in stories about abortion, while women had 12%, according to the research group Fourth Estate. In stories about birth control, 75% of the quotes were from men, with women getting 19%. If Mitt Romney wins the presidential election and enacts his own tax proposal, he'll pay half what he would pay under President Obama's tax plan, saving almost $5 million a year. Losing the election would provide a windfall for Obama, as his own tax bill would fall by $90,000 under President Romney. And the U.S. industry is highly vulnerable to the kind of cyber attack that disabled Iranian nuclear fuel centrifuges. A data security firm recently tested 7 control systems of the sort used in power plants, water plants, and industrial control systems, and was easily able to hack into 6 of them. And our poll watch for this week, 82% of Americans say they have a favorable opinion of Queen Elizabeth II as she celebrates 60 years on the throne. Her popularity in the U.S. plunged to 47% in 1997 following Princess Diana's death. And 66% of American parents say the risk of concussion would not deter them from allowing their children to play football, while 26% say that it certainly would. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.